Jeff, you're not the only one. You know, sometimes it goes just beautifully, and other times we have quite a few tech issues. The issue is you're in your house in Ealing, and I'm in a house in London that I don't normally in. And
Oh,
Jeff
right.
and Josh lives on a houseboat on the Thames. So, you
Oh,
know.
wow.
Yeah.
Well, we must talk about that separately because Rita is always walking along the Grand Union Canal and loves it. And so we must talk about houseboats sometime.
Hi, I'm Cormac.
And I'm Josh.
Welcome to the Living Project.
Be true, live wild.
Hello, and welcome to episode 20 of the Living Project podcast. Today we're joined by Jeff Payne, a lifelong learner, teacher, glider pilot, and environmentalist. He's joining us from his multi-generational home in Ealing, London.
I've had the pleasure of knowing Jeff for over 20 years. We worked together during the late 1990s on a UK government-funded land and housing project in the landlocked African country of Lesotho. Jeff has been a mentor, a friend, and an inspiration. Our chat today catches him in a reflective mood as he commences the writing of a new book, drawing on his past 50 years of travels, work, and wild adventure flying high. In his glider, of course. He says, "You can't tame the wild, but you can seek to understand it and work with it. We are part of nature." This seems like good advice given our very real global challenges. He highlights a paradox at the heart of finding solutions. How to connect with what we have and what is local, and the need to explore and reach out to a bigger world.
This is an inspiring chat. We hope you enjoy it.
So now we might as well, well, we've already started. So Jeff, it'd be really, tell us, well, how are you and where are you talking to us from?
Well, I'm feeling extremely well and extremely lucky. I mean, when I think of all the suffering so many people are going through at the moment, with the climate crisis, job uncertainty, isolation from friends and family, I am in a very, very fortunate position in the sense that I've got the family with me, including our daughter Tania, partner Vijay. We celebrated the first birthday of one of our grandsons, the other's four, and they live on the top floor of our house. So we see them every day. We can see them growing and changing and
lovely.
Have great fun with them. We've got a garden we can run around in. We're fortunately financially secure, and I've got lots of interesting things to do, as has Rita herself, on fighting for media freedom and developing the Commonwealth, and so on. So I have to say I feel incredibly lucky.
Yeah, it's lovely to hear that gratitude at these times, alongside, you know, compassion and concern for people who, you know, are less fortunate, are not in those situations. And I think we're all trying to work out where we sit in that and how we feel about those things. But it's lovely to have you on the show, Jeff. It's lovely to meet you. I've heard a lot about you from Cormac, so I'm really looking forward to this conversation. I'm sure you know by now that the first question we ask every guest to begin these conversations is, here at the Living Project, we work with a belief that human life is a fluid balance between four key elements of water, earth, fire, and air. And you've just spoken a little bit about gratitude and luck and those type of things, but I'm wondering which of those elements resonates with you the most and why.
Well, it has to be air. Ever since I was a child, I was fascinated by the sky, the way it changed, the fact that birds enjoy flying all over the world, and the freedom that that gives to explore and to enjoy. I was fascinated from that from being a very, very young boy. And although I lived next to the sea, and I did take up sailing, which I found good. Even then, with sailing, the air is a critical element. So really, it's the air that's always been the fascination. And that's certainly the element that I identify with. And I took up making models when I was a little boy, making model gliders and seeing those fly off, sometimes to the point of destruction, sometimes vanishing. I never saw them again. Aviation was my real passion as a child. And oddly enough, when my school closed down some years ago, we went to dig out things that we could find about the previous days. And I found a lot of my old school notebooks, exercise books on history, geography, all those sort of things. And the funny thing was, looking in the margins of my notebooks, of all my school essays, were pictures of gliders and jets and helicopters. And so that showed me where my mind was while I was supposed to be working on school things. And I joined the Air Training Corps as soon as I was able to. I took up gliding at the age of 15. I went solo at 16. I was an assistant instructor at 17. And I wanted to become a pilot and join the Air Force. And I went for a medical and was absolutely distraught. This was my big, possibly my only big, real disappointment in life, in that I failed the medical, knew I couldn't do it. But a retired wing commander said, "Don't worry, lad, you know, you sign on for 12 years, show them you're really committed and they'll let you fly." You should have known better. But I did stupidly leave school without my A-levels. And I phoned my mother and said, "Hi, Mum, I won't be home until I've done my basic training. I've signed on for 12 years. And that must have been a terrible, terrible shock for my parents. I had a great time in the Air Force. I mean, obviously didn't let me fly jets, but I did enter gliding competitions. We went on wave soaring expeditions in winter over the Lake District, looking for wave forms of lift, which is something we all understand now, but we didn't understand in the early 1960s. It was only when I taught an architect to fly a glider, and then he took me to see the house he'd bought, and he was driving a Jaguar and he bought his own plane, I thought, actually, that's the life for me. So I bought myself out of the Air Force, went back home, worked in the evenings to get my A-levels, and went to university and did architecture. So it's interesting how a negative can become a positive.
Yeah, all based on a love of the air.
Yeah, absolutely.
I love that. Have you ever heard that line from the film, "Never feel sorry for a guy with his own plane"?
I haven't. But my version of that is, gliding is the best way of getting high legally.
Jeff, you know, I've been lucky enough to go up in the glider with you several times. You know, I'm really interested to learn a little bit more about your take on your relationship with the air, because is it, or maybe it is in one sense, but is it about man taming the wild elements? Or is it, are there moments when you know that you are at the mercy of the wild elements? What's it like being up in a glider? And what's your relationship with those elements, particularly air?
Well, there's certainly no way you can even conceive of taming the air. I mean, I think if the pandemic has taught us anything, is that we're not masters of the universe. We're creatures with very limited understanding, although we are very clever. But the world is a fascinating, ever-changing place, and our interaction with it, of course, as we're finding with climate change now, the jet stream is changing, the nature of our day-to-day climate. We're getting more storms, we're getting more droughts, we're finding that the air is changing around us. And our behavior, the way we treat the planet, the way we treat each other, is influencing that massively. Yeah. And a lot of people, of course, are in denial, but I think the majority of people now understand that the way we live affects the air around us, the air we breathe. I mean, for example, the pandemic saved a lot of people's lives in China, where on average 1.2 million people a year die of air pollution. So bad air is a killer. And yet when the pandemic came in, all those people were able to, most of those people survived, although of course some died with the virus. But for the first time ever in living memory, people in New Delhi were able to see the Himalayas. And so it's not a question of taming, it's trying to understand and work with nature. So if you understand what the air is doing, how it behaves, whether you're a sailor or a glider pilot, you really need to be continually being sensitive to how it's changing and what our actions do to impact on that, for good or bad.
Yeah. Jeff, you seem to definitely have an independent streak, a strong independent streak. You kind of described to us almost from an early age, you had a real sense of what you wanted to do. So I'm just wondering where you lived. You mentioned you lived by the sea and you had a happy childhood, but how did those things, do you think, influence who you were, that independent streak?
It's difficult to say, isn't it, what prompts it. I certain events in life, I think, help to explain bigger issues. They might be trivial at the time, but they symbolize something bigger. I remember we had an uncle, and every New Year's Eve, they would come to us on Boxing Day, and we would go to them on New Year's Eve. And they were lovely families, and they were slightly better off, well, quite better off than we were, and they were the first ones to get a television. And we went up for New Year's Eve one year. I was about 12 at the time. And they spent the evening watching other people enjoying themselves. I just wanted to play games and have fun with my cousins and so on. And they were watching other people enjoy themselves. And I thought, this isn't what I want. And I made an excuse and I walked home along the seafront. And I remember looking out to sea and thinking, there's got to be something more exciting out there somewhere. And so I suppose from that early age, I never felt I belonged in Western, although I couldn't have had a happier childhood. My parents were absolutely wonderful. They did everything possible for me and my two sisters. But I just felt I wanted to travel from a very early age. And I remember standing outside the house hitchhiking. And I was hitchhiking and the vicar passed by and said, "Good morning, Geoffrey." I said, "Good morning, vicar." He said, "Where are you going to?" I said, "Istanbul, vicar." And he stopped dead in his tracks as though, is there a road that goes all the way to Istanbul? And my history master at grammar school was proud of the fact that he'd never been outside Somerset. And that terrified me. You know, I mean, I thought, my God, what a constraint to put on yourself. Now, Somerset's a lovely country, but there's so much else in the world I wanted to see.
Let's run with that. Let's run with that, like that fire of there's so much in the world that you wanted to see. You've talked about this experience of the RAF and then meeting the architect and thinking that's what I want to do. You worked on some, you got into urban planning and housing. You did some work in Papua New Guinea, and you taught at Oxford Polytechnic, as it was then, Oxford Brookes now. And then in 1995, you established your own consultancy, and you've worked on projects to improve access to urban land and housing all over the world. And I guess what I'm interested to explore in that is, you've talked about a real developing and learning and understanding of a relationship with air. You've mentioned the climate crisis and how we need to learn to live with nature. I'm wondering how you assimilate or match working as a consultant in urban land and housing with an understanding of how to work with nature?
Well, obviously we are part of nature, and the way we treat the planet comes back to either benefit or haunt us. I went to Japan as a student because I was always interested in the cultural aspects of land and housing, and the fact that different cultures have different traditions. And in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, which Cormac knows very well, people's attitude to land is very much that you're a part of a community. Land is held in communal or government or state or a wider sense of ownership. And therefore you're continually reminded that you are part of a community, part of something bigger. Whereas what I find in the last 40 years, for example, globally, we've been stressing the rights of the individual. We've been looking at individual ownership of land. We've been looking at how individual rights are important. And I find that that has not made us any happier. It may have made us richer, but certainly not happier. Levels of stress are greater than they've certainly been for a long time. It made me question for a long time, and I'm writing a book at the moment about this, looking back over my experience, to ask myself what we actually mean by development. We talk about economics as though it's an end in itself. Prosperity, wealth, economic growth and so on are ends in themselves. But if they're not making us any happier or better, one has to say, well, what's it all for? And I'm raising that question at the moment, both for myself and with the people I'm working with, to say there's got to be something bigger than that. I think all of us, the pandemic's been a very good catalyst in making us realize that we are better when we work together. And so working in harmony with nature, using land carefully and wisely. You don't see the word wise very often these days. One needs to see it much more, I think. And the sense of community, how we share the land, how we put it to good use environmentally. We don't destroy the forest. We don't fill the rivers with pollution and industrial waste. So I think all of this comes back to how we feel about ourselves and our relationship to nature. And of course, the air is one of the filters. If we pollute the environment, we're polluting our own lungs at the same time. So I think all these things are pretty well interacted. And what I've found over the years is that different cultures have different ways of dealing with these issues. Different economic political systems have different ways. But those that give a sense of community and regard for the wider world, the environment, I think are the ones that are going to do well in the future. And I have done well in the past.
Yeah. Do you have a sense, Jeff, of all these cultures you've visited and places you've been to, of, you know, where are some of those places that stand out for you that you think, you know, there's something they're doing right there that if we could just tap into and learn from, and that we would all be better off for it?
Well, one place that comes to mind very, very much with me is Vanuatu. Now, Vanuatu is noted for two things. It's environmentally the most vulnerable country in the world. It's got active volcanoes, suffering from sea level rise, and annual cyclones that come through and cause massive devastation. So it's got those three things that really are causing massive challenges. It's also, however, got the reputation of being the happiest country in the world. Now you say, well, how can those two things coexist? And what I found when I was there is that they've adjusted their lifestyle and their expectations to their local environment. Now, this is where I find myself being a bit uncomfortable, because, of course, that's exactly what I had when I was a child. And yet I wanted to get out and explore and not be content with those benefits that I had. So I do have to recognise that there's a massive contradiction in what I'm saying. They live in very, very modest houses. I mean, you can't even call them houses, really. They're wooden tents covered in palm leaves, coconut palm leaves. And of course, when the cyclone comes, they all take off to the church or the school, which are for concrete buildings, very strong buildings, and wait out the storms. And when they come back, the timber structures are still in place, the frames are still in place, and a lot of more coconut leaves have been blown off the trees, so they simply replace them and carry on. And all these NGOs come in with corrugated iron, and they say, we wouldn't touch that, that's dangerous. So they've adjusted their lifestyle. But of course, a lot of people, younger people, now are aware that there's a bigger world, and some of them are wanting to leave. So there is a tension, I suppose, in how does one create a world in which you are at peace with nature, where you are living in harmony with what's possible, and yet also having a contented, rich life.
Yeah, a sense of exploration from a point of understanding and exploration, and not from a sense of lack. So an ability to seek exploration and understanding in whatever is around you, and be present in whatever is around you. That's right.
And I mean, what I find at the moment personally is that while I'm certainly not the only one who's a bit depressed in terms of the politics and the economic situation that the world is in, and with so many people around the world, even in rich countries who are dependent on food banks and so on for survival, and the terrible stories you hear about suffering, which is unnecessary. That's what makes me angry. It's unnecessary in a rich country. I've never been intellectually more excited in my life, because I'd like to think that this pandemic will be the catalyst which no amount of political oratory or scientific evidence has so far been able to achieve, in making us reassess our relationship to each other, to other species, and to the world around us. I think that if we can create either the circular economy, the donut economy, a green, sustainable environment, all of these things, A, the air will be a lot clearer that we're breathing, and we'll be much more content. There's still opportunities for creativity, for imagination, and so on. And yet it does require a massive redistribution of wealth globally. So, and I think a greater level of equality around the world will be good for all of us.
Why not treat yourself or a loved one to some of the Living Project merchandise? We have 100% organic cotton and responsibly sourced t-shirts and trucker caps in black in various sizes for men and women. £19.99 plus post and packing. All are branded in bold white lettering with our strap line, Be True, Live Wild. They feel and look great. I use my trucker cap on my trail runs, but it works equally well in the urban jungle. Just to make you feel even better, 5% of all clothing sales go to the John Muir Trust, a charity dedicated to protecting and enhancing wild places in the United Kingdom. While you're browsing, why not pick up Josh's beautiful little book called Swim, a slice of truth told through a story about the power of friendship. Pick it up for $4.95. We'll add a bit of goodness. 5% of all book sales go to Mind, a charity dedicated to making sure no one has to face a mental health problem alone. To make a purchase, go to the Living Project website, www.livingproject.life/merch. Go on, make a statement that you're living your truth and being wild. Jeff, I'm really interested to know a little bit more about your own personal journey. I know that you spent a lot of time in an institution in Oxford Brookes University, or Oxford Poly as it was, but you took at some point the leap and you decided to leave that comfort and to form your own company. And I think that's about 25 years ago. So I really want to know, what was it in you, that fire that you had that ignited that change? Why did you do it? And what have you learned from that process of going out there on your own and doing it for yourself?
I love working with people. And, as I get older, my top priority, really, I suppose, is to try and pass on what I've learned to the next generation, the younger generation, because it was quite easy when I started. I mean, I got this scholarship to go to India and came back from India with a lot of information, obviously, and wanted to write it up. And I actually had help to get funding from the research councils. There's no way that sort of opportunity would be available to young professionals now. So I do love working with people. At the same time, I suppose if I'm honest, there's always been an element of me, part of me, that feels like an outsider.
Hmm.
And maybe that goes back to my childhood when I left Weston, that while I've enjoyed being in both Oxford Brookes and University College London for 5 years after that, I've always, I suppose, been questioning conventional wisdom, conventioning the norms of a group, and thinking, I wouldn't want to think I was the dust in the oyster, but I've always had that independent streak, which can, of course, come over very easily as bloody-mindedness, and I would confess to that to a degree. But I think that retaining that individual view of things and trying to see the connections between theory and practice. I've always enjoyed doing consultancy and research, even when I was teaching. And I think standing on those three legs has been very, very helpful to see the interaction between putting a theory to test in a consultancy and then coming back with the hard experience of consultancy and putting that into one's teaching. So there's that sort of continual recycling, as it were, of experience from theory, teaching, practice. And so in a way, I felt I'd had enough of teaching an academic environment. I was never interested in climbing corporate ladders or institutional ladders. I was always more interested in the issues themselves that I was working with. And in some senses, that may not have helped me professionally to become a professor or something. But at the same time, I felt it enabled me to explore things in the ways that suited my temperament and my outlook. So when I had the chance and when I went private and independent in 1995, I thought, well, this is a big opportunity. I was over 50, which isn't perhaps the best stage of life to be starting a new career.
50 is the new 40, Jeff.
50 is the new 30, I think, now, isn't it?
Yeah. Have you not seen how Cormac dresses? He's still at university.
Exactly. Well, yeah. I still consider myself a student.
Mm.
It's just that I've been doing it longer than many other people.
Yeah, I suppose that's a nice interjection for me, if you don't mind, Jeff, that you've just talked about this recycling of knowledge, and we've touched on this passion of kind of learning and coming back, and that's what you did started kind of consultancy for, to go independent, to be able to have your own exploration, your own mind, and use that consultancy in that way, in terms of recycling your learning, providing it to others, learning more. You mentioned earlier you're writing a book about your experience and kind of what that means or what you think it means in terms of the situation moving forwards. So how are you? What's this book about? And how are you using that philosophy of recycling knowledge and learning, the cyclical process of it in this book?
It's a wonderful opportunity to go back over places that one has worked in before and renew friendships going back 20, 30 years sometimes. I've just been asked if I'd do a contribution to the Second Arab Land Conference in taking place in February next year. And that gives me a chance to collaborate with an Egyptian colleague and a very, very good academic who I've worked with for 35 years on and off. So it's, the book has been a great chance to do that. It's also been a chance to unburden myself and get, you know, a lot of things down, both in terms of analysis and also ways forward. I don't want the book to be simply a critique of current challenges. I want it to be a forward-looking book because, you know, we need to build on the positives if we're going to make progress and get out of the current dilemmas. But I do think also, I have to go back a little bit to say that part of the bloody-mindedness that I've had has, in a sense, helped me, because when I went independent, or just before I became independent, I was invited by the World Bank to do a paper on land, tenure and property rights. And I said, look, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not an economist, why are you asking me? And they said, well, I've written a book, a review of the literature on informal settlements. And partly because I'm the world's worst linguist, I've always taught students from countries where English may not be the primary language, I've been trying to put complex things into simple terms. And also because Rita, my wife, is a journalist, of course, she's always reminding me of the need to make complex issues clear. So I've been trying to do that. And so I then did that review, and the bank didn't like it. But they never gave a concrete reason why they didn't like it. And it was only when they published the review, they paid me, fortunately, which was nice, and they could publish, but not with any link to the World Bank. So I was very, very curious. It was only when they published their policy document that I realized why they didn't like it. And this was at a time when the World Bank was becoming very neoliberal. Very neoliberal. So when I went independent in 95, the first thing I did was to go to the UK government and say, look, I've done all this research. I did it 2 years ago. If I could have a small grant, I could update it and publish it as a British government document or acknowledging government support. So they gave me the grant, which is good of them, and they published it. And then I applied for research because of the bank was so committed to individual land titling and individual rights and so on, rather than community interests. So I managed to get a large series of research grants to actually explore whether this approach was valid or not. And it was when I went to present at the World Bank Land Policy Conference, I think it was 2004, I've presented the findings of my research, which completely repudiated everything the bank was doing. I was really very angry because the policy document they had was housing, enabling markets to work. Mm. Now, my view of life and working with people, great people like John Turner, was that the job of a professional is not to enable markets, but to enable people and to enable communities. And so I was very angry, and that's what prompted my presentation at the bank. And I was very touched afterwards, having got it all off my chest, when a senior person came and said to me that they realized the World Bank had, he said, put too many eggs in the omelette of individual ownership. Hmm. And I was invited for lunch, and that started me working with the World Bank. And I can't claim to have, changed things in many places, but it's been a very interesting process. And what I want to do in the book is to explore both the issues and the journeys that countries are making, whether they're going from customary ways of looking at land, whether they're looking at state control, whether they're looking at market-driven approaches, and to see those journeys and how they can be, as it were, guided towards a more harmonious collective way of treating the environment and nature generally.
Wow.
Well, Jeff, it's been absolutely wonderful and very insightful talking to you today, and you've shared with us your views of the wild and how that view of the wild is really about not about man taming the elements but working with them and that being really, really crucial to understand if we're going to sustain life on this planet in a fair and equal way moving forward. So you've shared something of the water, you've shared something of the earth and the fire within you, and clearly where you started off was talking about your love of gliding and being up in the air, and that was the element that you told us you resonated with more. Just to finish off, and I've got a question, because a mutual friend of ours told me that when they used to go to your lectures, and one day they went to the lecture and the door was closed, and there was a note on the front of the door saying, "Sorry, lecture cancelled, I've gone gliding, see you later." Is that true, Jeff?
If it is, I'm not going to admit to it.
I love it. That's the most guarded yes I've ever heard. Jeff, it's been an absolute treat. I have been fascinated by this conversation and wish it could go on longer and longer to learn more about this marrying of land planning with considering nature and your experience working with people who are responsible for how we treat the planet on a global scale. It's been a fascinating insight. Thank you,
Cormac. Thank you so much for inviting me for this. It's been an honour and a pleasure. It's the nearest I'll ever get to being on Desert Island Discs, I think.
Listeners, we hope you've really enjoyed this conversation today. The wild is clearly inextricably linked to Jeff's life all over the world, working with communities in housing and planning and with big institutions responsible for making huge decisions for all of us. I wonder what in the wild drives you. We look forward to seeing you again.
In the meantime,
be true, live wild.
You've been listening to The Living Project with Josh Bulpin and Cormac Davey.
Enjoyed it? Please subscribe, follow, rate, and share with everyone you know. See you next time.
Be true, live wild.